Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Midnight Black Mass, a production brought to you by GeorgeWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you discussions and interviews with figures of world wrestling, entertainment, and general pop culture. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Midnight Black Mass.
We'll be right back.
good evening to all of my groovy ghouls out there. This is the Maniacal Minister, the Occult, the Emperor of Evil, the Devil You Know, the Reverend Dane Wilson here. And I'm up at the podium for another sermon of the Midnight Black Mass. Last week, our special guest, standing for Pinhead on Hellraiser 3, Kevin Helms. Tremendous interview. You want to go check that out on the archive right now at gwhnews.com or blogtalkradio.com/PSP. You heard White Zombie opening the show off the classic 1992 La Sex Resisto Volume 1 Devil Music album. That song was called Welcome to Planet Motherfucker. You want to go on to Amazon.com, iTunes, any of your typical online stores, and make sure you help out old Rob Zombie and purchase your copy of that classic if you don't own it. And if you don't own it, or at least haven't owned a copy of it in your life, I don't really know why you're listening to this show. But anyway, on to the wrestling news. We got a big guest tonight. Before we get there, actually, I just want to plug Ms. Leslie Donaldson, the 80s Canadian scream queen, star of Happy Birthday to Me, Curtains, Funeral Home, and many other classic flicks. We're going to be engaging in an in-depth discussion on her career. But tomorrow night, Cornelia, Georgia, the Church of Southern Wrestling, the perfect place for the Reverend to rule, NWA Anarchy. I'll be there, of course, for the NWA Anarchy Heavyweight Champion and the Hate Junkies, the Devil's Rejects, back in full force to the cheers of the throngs of the masses. What the hell is going on? I'll be there to explain it to you. And Azrael in the main event will be defending his title against Bo Newsom, the nubile young protege of the Temptation, Shawn Tempers. And Azrael is going to take him to school like the Temptation never could in the ring and prove a point to Shawn Tempers. So Tempers, you better watch what he does to your boy, your little young boy, Bo Newsom, because it's coming for you next. Azrael will be the next NWA North American Heavyweight Champion. Hate Junkies also will be in action, kicking ass and taking names, as only they do. And it's going to go February 17th. If you're in the southeastern part of Tennessee, want to make the drive to Saturdays of Middle School for NWA Chattanooga, nwachattanooga.com. They got a big main event up there with the Temptation, Shawn Tempers, defending the North American title against the Southeastern champion, Tank, who will also be defending his title against the former Southern heavyweight champion, Ace Rockwell, in a triple threat match. Both of those major titles are going to be on the line. Whoever gets the pinfall could wind up a double champion. That's going to be a huge main event. Old school got Jesco Blue going toe-to-toe with Brian Casanova, Patrick Bentley against the returning Christian Haim, and a whole lot more. Reverend's going to be there lurking in the shadows. Seven is taking a little time off for some additional training, but you never know where he might be hiding. I might just bring him out a little early to strike. And then February 18th of 2012, I'll be back in Rossville, where I'm not only the Emperor of Evil, but the Emperor of Empire at Empire Pro Wrestling. And the Devil's Rejects have reigned supreme there for a long time, and the Reverend will be back. The last time I was there, I caused a riot, had a bunch of toothless inbreds coming over the rails trying to kill me, but still I prevailed. But I'm going to have a little tighter security measures when I return there, you bunch of damn heathens. On to the music news. The band Slayer, of course, coming up on Valentine's Day, synonymous with Slayer. And they have made it very clear that they're sending their love to their fans this Valentine's Day with a special free Slayer condom giveaway. That's right, right before Valentine's Day, with a purchase of a woman's I Heart Slayer or a men's fucking Slayer t-shirt, you will get a free Slayer condom included with your purchase, making sure that procreation is on the minimum. Certainly are the thrash metal legend Slayer, and I hear they're in the studio. Hope to have a new album out by May, so we're really excited about that. We talked about Howard Jones of Killswitch Engage leaving the band a few weeks ago. They have announced his replacement. It will actually be their original frontman, Jesse Leach. So what about that? British grindcore legends, maybe inventors of that genre, Napalm Death. New album coming out on February 28th called Utilitarian. And Barney Greenway and the boys from Britain always bring the heavy, heavy metal. And I'm sure the release on February 28th won't be any different. Metallica has announced a two-day festival coming up in New Jersey, June 23rd and 24th. They will play the Black Album in its entirety and perhaps Ride the Lightning. They've toyed with a lot of strange acts in terms of Metallica here, so I don't know. Looks like they're aiming more for the mainstream here, but you got bands like Arctic Monkeys, Avenged Sevenfold, The Sword, Liturgy, and Cage the Elephant have all been announced for this festival. It's going to be called the Orion Plus Music Festival. So not sure how I feel about that, but, you know, Metallica's going to be out there making that money, so what can you say? Legendary Cannibal Corpse, death metal pioneers, have announced a new headlining tour. They also have a new album coming out on March 13th, appropriately titled Torture. Gotta love Cannibal Corpse. They never fail to deliver the brutality. Okay, fans, well, that is your music news. We're going to go to some more tunes. We'll be back with the Muji Movie Minute and our special guest, Leslie Donaldson, and a whole lot more here on the Midnight Black Mass. Right now, we're going to go back to 1986 for a band that I'm planning on seeing coming up the 22nd of this month in Center Stage Theater. Now, at this time, in Atlanta, Georgia, they're going to be doing a 20th anniversary tour of the Five-Man Acoustical Jam. So it's a little bit different flavor than what I'm about to bring you here. But still, Tesla, a great underrated band of the 80s, always got lumped in with the hair metal bands. I always thought they had much more staying power as a hard rock band, and you can hear it here with one awesome song. Actually, first time I heard this was Features in the Background of Metallica's Cliff 'Em All video. The band's in there listening to the tunes. They run out of beer, and they make a whole hubbub about it. Cliff's in the video, and this song's playing in the background, and it rocks balls. So here it is, Jeff Keith and the boys in Tesla with Coming At You Live off Mechanical Resonance.
Believe it's coming.
classic album Mechanical Resonance with Coming At You Live. As always, go to Amazon, iTunes, your internet sales marketplaces, and make sure you support that band if you haven't added that tremendous album to your collection. Go classic rock, prog rock, everything, you name it, on that album. It's absolutely fantastic release. But fans, we actually got a very special edition of the show for you tonight. In addition to our amazing special guest, Leslie Donaldson, we have a live in-studio Muji Movie Minute coming up. We actually, here at the compound, Muji has joined me along with fellow Devil's Reject Rufus Black. And so we're going to be giving an extensive commentary later in the comic book news section of the show in lieu of some of the other segments tonight. But of course, as always, each and every week we bring you, it is time for the Muji Movie Minute. And right now, and I'm going to give the floor to the great Muji himself to talk about the Innkeepers.
Hello. The first movie, as the Rev said, I'm going to be talking about today is The Innkeepers. It's from 2011. It's actually new. It came out on pay-per-view in a couple theaters just a couple months ago, and now you can get it on DVD already. It's directed by Ty West, who we've already reviewed a couple of his movies. We did the
House of the Devil.
The House of the Devil, which we reviewed very well here. It was very good. And he also did the really, really funny Cabin Fever 2. So we've already liked a couple of the movies that he did. Now, the basic premise for the story is there is an old hotel. They don't say exactly where it's at, but it's up north. It seems like it's in, like, the Boston area that's shutting down. And a couple of people are working there by themselves on the last night that it's open. And the hotel has a ghost story. There's a chick who went there on her wedding night, and her fiancé left her, and she committed suicide, and so supposedly her ghost has been haunting the place ever since. And basically, the whole movie, the two main characters are doing a bit of a, like, trying to figure out if there's a ghost there. They have some equipment, trying to record things, doing a little ghost hunters bit to find out if it's haunted. And, of course, as the movie goes on, you know, they figure out that it is indeed haunted. The movie has some really good things in it. Like, it looks great. It's a low-budget movie, but it looks like a big-budget movie. The basic premise of the story is not that original, but it's pretty good. There's some creepy things in it, a couple of the actual moments, like the first time that you see the woman's ghost, and then the first time that anybody actually dies in it, are really scary moments. But overall, it was just missing a little bit. The acting and the dialogue in it, like, wasn't great, and also the story doesn't really tie together all that great. The lady is haunting the place. They don't really, you know, they kind of tell you why she's haunting the place a little bit. You kind of have to really infer it. Like, being somebody that watches a ton of horror movies, we were able to figure out what was going on, but if you weren't, like, obsessed with horror movies, it seemed like you may have absolutely no idea why she's haunting the place, or even some of the characters. At one point, her husband from many years ago comes in, and he drops a couple hints that he's the guy, but it was, you know, actually kind of tough to figure out that's who he was. He didn't give very clear hints. So liked it, but didn't love it. I actually gave it 60% well done.
60% well done for The Innkeepers. In my opinion, it was a bit underwhelming. I was really looking forward to it, given that we'd enjoyed the Ty West's work previously in the other two movies that we talked about. But, you know, it was just a little on the bland side for the Rev as well. I certainly didn't hate it, but I didn't love it.
Yeah, definitely. It was a movie worth watching, but not one that's really probably worth owning. And then the second one that we're going to talk about is the 2011 remake of Fright Night. This one's starring Colin Farrell. It's a pretty similar plot to the original movie, like the basic outline. There's a kid, finds out his neighbor is a vampire, finds out everybody else in the neighborhood is disappearing, so he investigates, and of course when, you know, the neighbor actually discovers that he knows he's a vampire, comes after and tries to kill him. Same basic story. It's a lot different than the original, though. Like, this one seems like it was made more for a mainstream audience, like trying to get the little girls in there and stuff. I like a lot of the things they did. You know, a lot of it was just built around Colin Farrell being able to seduce all the women that lived in the town. It was definitely made for people who are probably, like, teenagers now, whereas the first one had a lot of, like, stuff that go to, like, you know, just fans of horror movies. It had a lot of inside stuff that, unless you really liked horror movies, you wouldn't have even got. It was kind of goofy. The kid in the original movie was obsessed with horror movies, and that's why he thought his neighbor was a vampire, which was a lot of what made that movie work. And this one, that's not the case. It just happens upon him. It's an okay movie. It's one that's, you know, it's all right. There's really nothing scary about it, but it's, you know, a decent little flick. I would give this one 50% well done.
And I did not partake in the viewing of Fright Night. I really didn't have a lot of interest in, and your review pretty much affirmed that. The original Fright Night, sure, it certainly didn't rank among my favorites, but it was a fun little movie, I thought, you know, and had a little bit of a spirit. And I just couldn't see this sleek new remake having the soul of the original, and I think that's probably exactly where it fell short. Muji, any final thoughts on this week's Muji Movie Minute? We know we're going to have you back on here later when we get into our comic book and general sci-fi geekery discussion later, the roundtable compound panel that's coming up. But anything, any final thoughts on this week's Muji Movie Minute?
I'm going to peruse the Netflix, see what's coming out, and next week we'll have something good to watch. It's been a while, so next week we'll have something that we like.
That's it, folks. You've got the Muji guarantee that we're going to have something good next week, and we absolutely believe it to be so. Coming up right now, we got more music. One of the all-time greatest heavy metal bands to ever draw a breath, Pantera, the Cowboys from Hell, with their theme song, so to speak, off of 1997's official Live 101 Proof. Here's Pantera with, as I said, Cowboys from Hell.
weekend, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling. And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire.
Formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Okay, and we are back live on the Midnight Black Mass. That was Pantera off of Official Live 101 Proof from 1997 with Cowboys from Hell. As always, go over to Pantera.com and Amazon.com, iTunes.com, all of your typical internet marketplaces, and purchase your copy of that today. Ladies and gentlemen, we are honored at this time to bring our very special guests onto the air. Ladies and gentlemen, Leslie Donaldson. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
You doing very well. About yourself?
I'm doing very well, too.
Outstanding.
Thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely. We greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. Now, you know, here on the Midnight Black Mass, we focus on all entertainment on the fringe, so with a distinct love for horror films, that obviously will be our primary topic of discussion tonight. But I hear you actually got into the entertainment world at an extremely young age. Would you mind taking us on that journey and how it led you into film?
Sure. I started when I was about 9. I started modeling. My mother used to model, so I saw a lot of photographs that she used to do. And basically, I thought I could do it too. So she started taking me to classes, and I found out that I was actually pretty good at it. So I joined the agency, and I started doing a lot of print work, and I did a lot of Sears catalog work and stuff like that, runway stuff for kids. And then I eventually got an agent for commercials, and I started doing commercials, and then one thing led to another. I got auditions for television films, and then the features came. So it was pretty kind of a steady progression through the early years for me. And it was through print work, really.
Very interesting. And then you actually, in one of your early film roles in The Running, you starred alongside film legend Michael Douglas. Now, can you take us a bit inside that experience and what it was like being around such a seasoned veteran?
Yeah, it was pretty wild. You know, it was the first feature film I think I even ever auditioned for, actually, because I did a couple of CBC television movies, and based on those I got this audition. And what was really wild about it is that I got the part initially, and I think there was some kind of, you know, deal with Michael being in his early 30s. And I was in my I was 14 at the time, and he felt that I was too old to be his daughter. So So basically I was told I had the part, and then I went away and I came back and my agent said, no, you don't have the part. So I went to, I had to go to meet the director, in a private meeting and with Michael Douglas, because he was, you know, he wanted to meet me in person just to see if it worked out. And so I brought my grandmother with me, and, my grandmother was, you know, one of my best friends. She was really great, Scottish lady with a lot of wisdom and, life on her face. And so we went into this interview, and, I'm talking to the director, and, basically, Michael Douglas is, you know, completely ignoring me the whole time, and he's staring at my grandmother. And so there's a lull in the conversation, and she in her thick Scottish brogue just turned to him and was, you know, why are you staring at me? And, you know, he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to be staring at your, you know, at you like this. You have to understand, I don't ever see, you know, a face like yours. You just have the most beautiful face. And she said, what, I have all these wrinkles in my face. And he said, no, it's beautiful. You have to understand where I come from in Hollywood. Nobody looks like that. It's just incredible. So basically I credit my grandmother with getting me that role in Running. But he was amazing. I mean, he was an amazing man. He was very generous to work with. He was, you know, very down to earth, very professional. And, yeah, I mean, for somebody like me, for a first feature film, it was an incredible experience. So that was that was great, yeah.
That's excellent. Thank you for sharing that. That's a very intriguing insight into the world of film. Now, shortly thereafter, you were cast actually as the lead, if I'm not mistaken, in 1980's Funeral Home.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the moment that every young actress hopes to sink her teeth into, or was it the opposite? Was it the gigantic, nerve-wracking experience?
No, it was a bit of both, but I mean, it was that's the moment that you want. I mean, you get an audition, you're auditioning for the lead in a film, and it's a, you know, it's a horror film. For me at that time, you know, I loved horror films growing up. I went to see all the Hammer horror films, so my aunt used to take me when I was a kid, and so I was really jazzed about it. You know, when I read the script, I didn't really think that it was a full blown horror film. It was more sort of, you know, dark and mysterious and kind of, you know, I just liken it to Little Red Riding Hood meets Psycho. So, but yeah, I mean, it was incredible. And I think, you know, having done the experience with Running, I think I just at that particular time had the right quality for this particular character. So it didn't take a lot of convincing to get that role. So yeah, I mean, it was nerve-wracking though, because you're required to be on the set every day. I mean, you're kind of carrying the film. So, and I really had no experience with that. So I relied a lot on Kay Hawtrey, who was, you know, a veteran and, you know, played the grandmother. And, yeah, I mean, it was a fabulous experience. I mean, it was just, and it was so much fun to do. So.
And it became the first in a little bit of a streak that you would have in the horror genre.
It did.
Coming up. Shortly thereafter was Happy Birthday to Me. While your screen time was certainly limited, it was very, very memorable.
One of the
most famous roles, I think, that you had. Just the movie has achieved a great cult status now, I'm sure you know.
Yes. Yeah, it has, yeah.
You did kind of discuss how that kind of came about and then just the whole experience of Happy Birthday as much as you'd like to delve into.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I did, you know, I did Funeral Home, and then, you know, and then I did some plays and stuff, and then, of course, you know, the agent calls, and it's, you know, oh, there's another, you know, there's an audition for another horror film, and I'm thinking, okay, is this going to be a trend? Because, you know, I did Funeral Home, but it was Happy Birthday to Me, and it was with Melissa Sue Anderson, and Glenn Ford was in it, and so I went in and I auditioned, and it wasn't really, you know, a long process for me to get that role, because it was you know, small role and the beginning of the film. And again, I think it was really sort of, I had the right look at the right time. You know, they wanted sort of somebody kind of, you know, innocent and, you know, who could kind of, you know, pull at your heartstrings, I guess, because that's, I think, kind of what the first girl does when in horror movies. They set everything up to come. So, and then, of course, they can deliver the sassy line at the same time. So, you know, Winston, good old Winston there. So, I mean, it was just, it was really great. I was really jazzed about it because, for me, I was getting to work with all these great actors that were doing comedies that I wanted to do. You know, Jack Bloom, Matt Craven, they were in Meatballs, and they'd done all these sort of, you know, great fun movies. And I was like, damn, I really want to be in those movies. So I was really jazzed to work with them and to work with Lenore Zann and, you know, my peer group. So, I mean, I didn't really care about Glenn Ford. And to be quite honest with you, I had no clue who Jigley Thompson was at all at the time. I mean, I had no clue. That's how naive I was. I didn't know he'd done Cape Fear. I didn't know he did Guns of Navarone. I mean, I was just such, I mean, I was so green. It was just, it was pretty pathetic. It wasn't until years later I was like, oh, my God, that he did what? He was Cape Fear? Oh, my God, I didn't, thank God I didn't know that because I really would have been terrified. He was just like this weird little man that used to just run around, you know, when I had to do the scene where my head is on the platform, the platter there. He just, you know, would run around saying, throw more blood on it, throw more blood, we need more blood, we need more blood. So, it was really great. I mean, it was, you know, and it was a very short, you know, shooting schedule for me because I just, you know, I had the sort of couple of days where I had to do the death scene and then there was the week at the, you know, the week where we had to shoot the party scene at the end. So, so it was a lot of fun. It was just, it was great.
No, I've heard you talk about the makeup in previous interviews or some of the effects that you had to be involved in with that film and how some of it, as many who suffer for their art, some of those effects and prosthetics can be quite uncomfortable. Care to talk about that?
You know, it's one of those things where you're in the makeup chair for like 4 o'clock in the morning for like 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, you're all there and you're all getting your various, you know, death mask on. And you have to stay in the makeup, you know, it's like a 3 hour, you know, process. So the shoot would start at like 9. So you'd be there like 4 or something in the morning, but you have to stay in the makeup all day. I mean, that's it. Once it's on and that's, you know, get out of it until the end of the day. So, so you're eating lunch and there's Richard Ribiere with his neck looking, you know, and then there's, you know, René Levesque with his, you know, half his face off and, you know, so it's kind of gross, you know, you finally get used to it. But I do have a funny story actually with that. I remember one day we just got, Richard Ribiere and myself just got completely bored after lunch and we decided we would take a little walk in the neighborhood. So, you know, this was like August, you know, it wasn't Halloween. So there's no reason for people walking around with makeup on like us. So we did. We just ventured off out of the studio and took a little walk around the block in Montreal. We went up, you know, up the street and the kid was coming down on his bike and kind of went off his bike and fell. And it was like, oh, my God. And we walked along St. Catharines and people in cars were like, oh, you know. And then there, of course, there were other people that were like, oh, there's a movie studio down the street. They're just actors. Forget it. But it was fun. You know, when you're young, you can get away with doing really goofy stuff like that. So, but yeah, I mean, it was a heavy duty process. But you know, I'm just sitting there dead, so it really wasn't, you know, that big a deal. But right. the whole makeup process is, you know, very intricate and involved. So it's interesting to watch them do it.
It's been a common theme with many of our past guests who've worked in the horror genre at one time or another is the difficulty of the makeup.
Yes.
You know, speaking of happy birthday to me, I just got to say, on a personal level, there's something about those Canadian slasher films that I absolutely love.
Effects,
you know, so ahead of their time, a lot of creativity going on, like Happy Birthday is one. Of course, My Bloody Valentine, a very famous Canadian slasher film, came out around the same time.
In the States,
didn't you think that maybe they were kind of overexposed at the time? And I really thought those films stood out from the pack.
Right. Well, you had, you know, I mean, they were really trying to model themselves after, you know, Friday the 13th and prom night and, you know, Halloween and all of that. But, yeah, I mean, I think for some reason the Canadian horror films tended to kind of go a little more with the gore. I don't know why that is. You know, the stories were very convoluted, though. That's, I think, why, you know, they didn't have, you know, the box office appeal maybe that something like a Friday the 13th would have, or Halloween, which is, you know, a very sort of simple kind of progressive story. You look at Happy Birthday to Me, and it's kind of convoluted. Well, who's the killer? And then they didn't know, and then they were trying to figure it out while they were doing it. And so, but, you know, yeah, I think we had, you know, at that time we had Peter Simpson to really thank for that, because he was a producer for SimCom, and he was primarily produced a lot of those films. So, and he just, you know, he was just out there. You know, he wanted all the gore he could get. So, yeah, I think that you know, he was very daring in that regard, and the Canadian films were daring.
Yeah, I've always been interested in the comparison of the Canadian and American culture in that respect, because it does seem that you guys' television has always been a bit more intense than what they would show on network TV over here. And I'm always kind of jealous of that. You know, they can do so much up there.
Yeah, well, they always, you know, kind of model themselves after the Brits, too. They kind of do, you know, because they've sort of got the British BBC connection, the CBC. They try to emulate that kind of, you know, television filmmaking, or, you know, television movies. But, you know, with feature films, they're very much, you know, geared by what Hollywood is doing. So they have a hard time kind of creating their own filmmaking scene. I think that's, you know, they have a great television life, but the films are just, you know, they're still learning. And with Cronenberg is, thank God for him, because he's got his own style and he's amazing. And then there's Adam McGuigan as well. So these guys are coming to the forefront, and they're really bringing their own style. And that's hopefully, you know, what's leading Canadian films to where hopefully they'll be, you know, considered up there, you know.
And it's the world of the information age now, so, you know, it's easier to have people see things, but then it's also easier to get things out there to compete, so it's a bit of a double-edged sword, but I've always appreciated the Canadian artistic integrity.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you.
Absolutely. In the realm of the horror genre, you went on to do Curtains and Deadly Eyes. Any thoughts just on those films in summary?
Well, you know, I mean, what can I say about Curtains? It always stumps me to, you know, when people come up to me and say, oh, man, Curtains is so amazing. I just loved that movie. It was like my favorite movie when I was 2 or like 10 or whatever. And it changed my, you know, you were so scary in the eyes. And I'm like, really? You actually saw it? I didn't think anybody, first of all, I didn't even think it was ever going to get made, because it just was so, you know, imbued and embedded with such trauma and drama between, you know, people tend to think, well, was it with you actresses? Did you all, like, not get along? And no, it was like, really, it was the producer and the director that had the catfight. It wasn't the actresses. We all got along fine. It was just, they were the ones that were having trouble. So I think Curtains is just one of those fluky films that people tend to like. Either if they've seen it, they tend to like it, because I think they're just sort of wrapped up in all the mystery and the drama of it all. You know, with Peter Simpson and the director. His name escapes me. I'm having a senior moment. But, you know, so I think that and then with Deadly Eyes, I think it's the whole thing with the dogs, you know, in the outfit, and the Dachshunds in the rat outfits and the rat suits, that that intrigue people for some reason. I think that's kind of a lesser known movie as well. So I don't know how many people have actually seen that one. But
it's a pretty cult status film as well, in terms of just, you know, avid horror fans. But there's a certain purity in those types of movies to me from that era. It was pre-CGI. A lot of creativity went into creating these scenarios where now you can just kind of push a button and it happens. Put a lot of people out of work, or maybe force them into another line. I don't know. But I really love the simplistic nature of it, but the creativity that went into films like that.
Yeah. Blood, sweat, and tears. Absolutely, for sure.
after the run of horror films that you did kind of came to a close, I was just looking over IMDb doing my research here on the interview, and I saw you've stayed pretty busy since that era came to a close. I see numerous TV and voiceover credits.
Right.
One of those being a part in Friday the 13th, the series, is that true or accurate?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I was a guest star on Friday the 13th. I played in an episode called The Great Montaro, which was about this magic box that with knives in it, and you close it down. You have to give a victim to another box in another room. And then the Great Montaro can go into the box and the knives won't kill him. So I played his daughter. Graham Campbell was the actor that played that character. And I was the nasty killer in that one. So I tried to get Roby in there and get her as a victim. So, that was like the late 80s when I did that. It was a great series, actually. It was a lot of fun to do. It's great. Ran for a while, too.
It also gets a lot of hate from some of the Friday the 13th, you know, the Jason Voorhees diehard
fans
out there, and I just don't understand. It wasn't Friday the 13th as you know, but there were still some really
interesting stories. Well, they stole the title. They just they took the title, and I'm not really sure, you know, why they took the title, but I guess they were trying to get tap into a certain fan base, and so they were trying to get the Friday the 13th fan base to come and watch this series, but it had nothing to do with anything to do with Friday the 13th, the movies. So,
right. Well, anyway, it was underappreciated in my opinion. Now, also, IMDb credits you as being involved in some of the Star Wars animated projects of the 80s, but I'm told that info might not be entirely accurate. Do you know where that even might have came from?
No, it's accurate. I did the first episode of Droids. I played the voice of Princess Kira, and I just did that one episode. And I think I might have done... Again, you know, there has to be to reach back a long way. A couple of episodes of the Ewoks, because I used to do a lot of voice work, and I used to do a lot of primarily commercial voice work, but I would get the odd animation thing every now and then. But how Droids came to me was just, you know, it was one of those things where they had already, you know, they'd already taped it with another actress, and the producers didn't like the tone of her voice, so they decided they needed to go with someone else. So I, you know, got lucky enough to get that position. So it was great because I was in there, you know, doing voice work with, you know, Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, and Long John Baldry, and it was really wonderful. So so it was a great experience for me. And the Ewoks, I'm just, you know, I just character stuff, you know, little bits, but I wasn't in it regularly. So I'm not sure why that's on the IMDb list there. But yeah, no, it was really great to be a part of Droids.
Oh, very interesting. Well, you know, horror is not the only geek-tastic things that we love here on the Midnight Black Mass. So
right.
Star Wars things would certainly fall into that as well. So,
oh, sure. Absolutely.
Well, now, you know, just beyond the horror and the work that you've done, we like to get inside the heads of our guests a little bit, knowing the influences on some of the things you talked earlier about, sneaking off to see Hammer horror films at your local cinema. You know, I love Hammer, some of the most atmospheric and just classic slow-building horror ever done. But you come across as a true fan of the genre in your interviews. Like, what are your absolute favorite horror films that just left a mark on your life?
Well, you know, I'm going to be really boring. I'm just going to say The Exorcist, because that really, you know, I mean, I know everybody says The Exorcist, but it actually... Movies that deal with that kind of subject matter for me, or ghosts, or, you know, hauntings, or stuff like that, they tend to be what I'm drawn to in the genre. I'm not so much of, you know, a slasher fan, actually, to be perfectly honest with you, even though I've done them. But I do, by the same token, I do, you know, I like Saw, and I, you know, Hostel. I mean, I watch those. If they're on, I watch them. In fact, you know, my friends are always like, what are you going to watch tonight? And, like, Saw 153? I mean, you're like, yeah, probably, because, you know. I love the genre, and I appreciate it, and I watch it, you know, not only as a fan, but I also watch it to see, you know, how they're moving things along in the industry. And, you know, I'm a huge vampire geek. I mean, I love vampires. I'm into True Blood. You know, I watch that avidly when it's on. And, you know, but I'm a purist vampire. I love Dracula and, you know, all the Hammer Horror Dracula films. And, you know, I kind of stop at Anne Rice and that's it. And I don't move beyond there, so you won't get me watching any Twilight stuff. But, no, I don't believe they glitter and glow. I'm not into teen angst, so, yeah, so I don't, I'm just, you know, kind of a purist that way, but, yeah, I mean, I just, you know, the Exorcist and, you know, The Changeling was another one that really was amazing. I just thought that was a really, another Canadian film, a really well-done movie, and The Sentinel, again, that was a freaky film as well to me. I remember seeing that when I was a kid and, you know, just being totally freaked out by that father figure coming out behind the door. It was a great movie, yeah, and great actors in it, too, Christopher Walken and, you know, all these amazing, you know, actors that had small parts in that movie. Ava Gardner was incredible. So, yeah, I mean, those are usually the kind of films that I tend to, you know, get jazzed about rather than the typical pleasure.
That's exactly what type of introspective look we want to get here. And just as we'll wrap up the interview here and let you go, but before we do, the final thing I'd like to ask you, and before thanking you, of course, for joining us and taking your time, it's been a fantastic interview and very interesting.
Oh, sure. Great.
But beyond, you know, you've talked about beyond horror in other interviews I've read that you're a big fan of music. Bands
oh,
like
yeah.
Heart and Rush made a big influence on you.
Right.
We're very big into the hard rock and heavy metal here. We talk, have a whole segment dedicated to music news and play a lot of music.
Right.
I've seen, you've said at times that sometimes you might have rather have been a rock star. So what about the music? Like The Exorcist made the mark on you in terms of a movie. What type of music made Leslie Donaldson the person she grew up to be?
Rush. No, I'm just kidding. no, I did, actually. I really did want to be. I wanted to venture into that, you know, that lifestyle when I was a kid. And I actually made a demo and took it down to AMC Records down in L.A. And I don't have an original musical thought in my head, so I couldn't write music. So at that time, it was, you know, people like Kate Bush and Stevie Nicks and, you know, Pat Benatar and, you know, people who did write their own music. That was very important. I mean, this was way before Britney Spears, you know, where people,
right.
you know, make the music for you and then they just get a, you know, a hot young thing and send it out there to sing it. Yeah, I mean, I was heavily into Kate. I loved Kate Bush when I was younger. I loved female singers. They wrote a lot of their own stuff. Then I sort of became kind of goth and got into The Cure and The Cult and Bauhaus and stuff like that and Sisters of Mercy. And then, you know, I just kind of went into a coma for a while and didn't really listen to anything. So except, you know, the typical U2 and, you know, sort of the generic stuff. And then now I'm just sort of, you know, getting kind of educated musically right now. I'm open. I really like Interpol. I'm a huge Interpol fan. You know, I mean, heavy metal, I like Metallica. And, you know, Linkin Park I'll listen to. I know I'm kind of geeky when it comes to music, but I still go back to, like, Heart and Rush and, you know, those bands as well. So, you know, they never left.
Absolutely.
My iPod still has them there, so.
I imagine growing up Canadian, Rush had a big impact. That every Canadian I think I've ever met
loves
Rush. I think it's a prerequisite. I mean, if you're a human breathing and have a pulse, you should love Rush. But
right. Well, I mean, Neil Peart.
Is,
exactly. You kind of have to. Otherwise, you can't call yourself Canadian. You don't like Rush, you can't be Canadian. But Neil Peart is an incredible drummer and a lyricist, so I mean he's brilliant. So they're fantastic.
It's outstanding. Well, Leslie, we'll let you go and thank you so much for taking your time. Any final plugs you wanted to get in or anything you got coming up?
There are some things coming up, but I can't really talk too much about them right now because I'm actually waiting for the director to announce their intent. But it will be great news when it does happen. And, you know, it'll be out there. So,
excellent.
So that's pretty much it. But
we'll keep us informed through the appropriate channels, and we'll make
I
sure
will.
To plug whatever you'd like us to plug for you. We greatly appreciate you taking the time.
Great.
It's been an awesome
thank
interview.
You.
Ladies and gentlemen, Leslie Donaldson, thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Have a great evening.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Leslie Donaldson, the 80s Canadian scream queen, took a fascinating ride into the world of film and television, for that matter, looking even into the Star Wars franchise, which we're going to be talking about in a little more detail coming up in the comic book news segment right after this next break. Right now, you're about to get a big bicep in your face with Glenn Danzig. This is off Danzig 3. This is the title track. How the Gods Kill. If you ain't got the answer, if you don't know the truth, if you want the power, then let it flow through. Would you let it go? Cannot end this morning of my life. Show me how the God kills. We'll be right back.
that cannot end this morning of my life. Show me how the gods
of the Midnight Black Mass with an exclusive General Geekery Roundtable here in live in studio in the compound. I have from the Muji Movie Minute, the great Muji, and member of the Devil's Rejects, Mr. Rufus Black. Basically, I'm going to hit each of these news topics. They're going to share their opinions on what they feel might be relevant or maybe want you to hear. So let's go with it. First up, Smallville. Remember Smallville, the story of young Clark Kent coming of age in Kansas and his journey to become Superman on the WB. Quite a polarizing show amongst comic book fans. Some think it's sacrilege because they tweak some of the origins. Some, like myself, just loved it. I was just happy to see the appearance of people like Deadshot and Deathstroke and Doomsday. And on television, I thought Michael Rosenbaum was one of the greatest, maybe the greatest Lex Luthor to have ever appeared on screen. And I thought Tom Welling was a hell of a Clark Kent and a Superman. So, you know, unfortunate that the show was canceled, but remember it because it's back, returning for an 11th season in comic book form. Written by original Smallville scribe Brian Q. Miller. This will pick up very shortly after the final episode of Season 10, where Clark became Superman and saved the day, wearing finally the Superman suit and gained his ability to fly. Muji actually was the person who introduced me to the Smallville franchise. He kept saying, Dan, you gotta watch this, you gotta watch this. And I kept saying, it's gay, Muji. No, I don't want to watch it. It's going to be Dawson's Creek with superheroes. And the first couple seasons were. You know, the first couple seasons pretty much were. But as they became coming of age and got out of high school, it certainly turned into an action-packed drama. So what are your thoughts on the resurrection of Smallville, Muji?
Well, I'm a little excited that they're doing the comic book. You know, I just hope that it's good like the show. You know, I think that probably if they knew for sure they were going to do the comic book, they might have not ended it exactly the way that they did, just because they tried to tie up a lot of loose ends by doing, you know, they did the classic Smallville. If you did something that was out of continuity with the DC Universe and somebody got hit on the head and just forgot everything. So that's pretty much how they just reset everyone to their movie, you know, the way that they are in the universe and the other movies. But it's exciting, you know, hope that it's good. You know, you get some characters that aren't really in the other Superman comics that are in Smallville that'll get to keep living on. And Also, I'd just like to say, I don't see why you didn't immediately start watching Smallville, because I think I did accurately describe it as it's like Dawson's Creek, but Dawson is fucking Superman. That should have been enough.
Fair enough. Rufus, any thoughts on this? No, I know you didn't really follow the Smallville franchise, and it was never really your bag, but I'm sure you'll be quite opinionated on some of our upcoming topics. Very interesting topic. Ghost Rider creator ordered to stop being Ghost Rider creator. That headline courtesy of ComicsAlliance.com. And he was also ordered to pay Marvel $17,000 in damages. That's right. Gary Friedrich, the creator of Marvel Comics' demonic motorcyclist Ghost Rider, has been ordered by a judge to renounce his creator credit and pay $17,000 in damages to his former employer following a court battle that began in 2007 disputing legal ownership of the character. The news comes from the blog of Daniel Best, who has posted official documentation of the judge's orders that effectively prohibit Friedrich from claiming to have created Ghost Rider or selling any unlicensed Ghost Rider-related merchandise of his own at cons. Wow. That news, courtesy of ComicsAlliance.com. And I really don't know what to think about that. You know, the guy created it. I guess he's got really shitty lawyers is the only thing I can think. That's unfortunate. Not enough information there for me to make an opinion on it. But next story is that Digital Comics earned $25 million in 2011. As we move into the digital age, more people are getting their comics in the electronic format. Of course, you've got the iPads and your telephones now all have these capabilities. You got laptops, you got notebooks, you got netbooks, et cetera, et cetera. So you can kind of capture the experience of having a real comic book, I guess. But and certainly I like scans, but to me, I always prefer the printed version, and I really hope that will never die. Moody, your thoughts?
I think reading comic books on either computer screen is a bit of Mark shit. That's what I'd like to say on that. You don't really get the same feel, I don't think. That's just my thing. You know, it's cool. It's a way for them to make more money, so, you know, more power to be able to make the more money, but it definitely isn't the same. You don't get, like, the covers. You don't get the artwork that you get to keep. You know, it's, you know, even if you have, like, an iPad or something, it's just not the same as, like, flipping through the comics. And you don't get to go to the comic book store to get the comics, which is half the fun of getting comics is going to pick through all of the comics and everything like that. So I think it takes a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah, also not a big fan. Just picking up. Yeah, also not a big fan of digital comic books. I think that kind of sucks. And maybe you'll know, because I don't know. Never really did it. If you're buying them legally, and say you have it, whatever, you got a digital comic that you bought legally somehow, and then that computer that it's on breaks down, are you out the comic? I mean, if you're out the comic, that really sucks, you know, to me. And, you know, because your hard drive crashed or whatever, I wonder if they keep, like, some sort of database on, like, you ordered it, so you'll have unlimited download of this comic book after you bought it. I don't know. I don't know how it works.
The couple of sites that I've gone to, actually, it's almost like a time limit thing. Like, you can download it for a certain amount of time, and it keeps it, like, in a queue, and that's something that'll probably get better. I would assume eventually that they'll just be able to download if you pay for it.
Right. Well, how much do they cost? How much does it cost?
Most digital comics are $1, so it is a cheaper way of getting off on it. I mean, you can get the comic for less money and everything, but that is also true. It's also, if you collect comics, I mean, if you read them, you do, but if you collect them, you know, you're not going to get any money. Your digital comic's not going to be worth $1,000 if the comic picks up, so it still seems like it's a cheaper way to read the stuff, but it's a much better investment just to buy them.
Yeah, I'm a big collector, so I like to have it. Same with books. I don't like to read. I don't have a laptop, but I feel like even if I did, it wouldn't be the same. Like, I like to hold a book. I just like to hold a book. Comic book, regular book. That's what I like.
Well, you got to have something to read while you're taking your morning constitution, you know. It's not the same experience when you're trying to read it on your telephone. I've tried to do that. Now, as far as digital comics, and that's a good question. I know they are giving away a lot of free digital comics with the purchase of the print versions now. I think that's probably a smart move. I just don't see how they can ever replace the real thing. But certainly good to know that an industry that's been in trouble for several years is making $25 million off of some business models. So it is a way of catching up with the times. And there's the whole piracy debate, and we could get into that, and we might here in just a minute. But next news item is the new Amazing Spider-Man trailer is hit, wowing audiences in a test run. Totally different than the original trailer that came out for this thing. I don't know if any of you have seen the extended trailer that's out there, but totally changed my opinion on the movie and made me incredibly excited for it. I had my doubts, certainly, going back to the Spider-Man origin story again. I feel like we just did this, but certainly looking at the trailer and the way they did the extended cut, the action looks phenomenal, the lizard looks phenomenal, the dialogue between the Spider-Man and Gwen Stacy was outstanding in the trailer. It was very touching. I really, really am looking forward to this now. So anybody with any thoughts want to weigh in on that? Rufus?
Yeah, I mean, it is really weird that they're restarting, they're rebooting everything like that. You know, it's like every 10 years you're just going to get a new Spider-Man thing. And it's kind of like how I've heard they're going to do with, you know, the Batman. It's like after Nolan's done that they're going to pretty much completely reboot it. And I think that's really stupid. I wish they would just, you know, start a continuity and kind of stick with it for at least longer than, like, you know, 8-10 years, which is what it seems like they just keep restarting them, which is annoying for me.
Yeah, it certainly can be, and I sympathize with that because I did enjoy the original trilogy. I think we've discussed on here before, won't belabor that, you know, one and two were excellent films. The third one was just a case of trying to cram too much stuff in, and therefore the final product suffered. But anyway, I'm looking forward to The Amazing Spider-Man this summer. The Revs pull list, going to run over that. This is what I'm reading this month and coming up soon, and my recommendations to you out there, the fine listeners. I'll also let Muji give you his pull list when I'm done, but right now I'm reading Justice League Dark, The Adventures of the Magical Powered Heroes of the DC Universe, all banding together to fight the threats coming from the dark side, and it's quite an entertaining read so far, though I know they're shaking up the creative team soon. And Animal Man's Jeff Lemire will be taking over writing duties on that title. Aquaman, I've sang the praises of Aquaman time and time again. Jeff Johns has reinvented this character like he did for Green Lantern, honestly, in the same respect. And I really look forward to where they're going with Aquaman. The Flash has been outstanding. Animal Man is probably the must-read comic going right now. It's just incredibly crazy. Swamp Thing is awesome. Deadpool has been highly entertaining as now Deadpool is trying to kill himself moving into this new arc. Will he succeed? Who knows? The Winter Soldier number one just came out this week. I haven't had a chance to read it, but it's Ed Brubaker and it's Bucky Barnes, so I'm sold. You know it's going to be good. Just added The Avengers by Brian Michael Bendis to my pull list. It's got a great story going on right now where Norman Osborn has gotten out of prison and he's created a new hammer, which was his shield while he was running the Avengers during the Dark Reign era. And of course now the new hammer is a global crime syndicate including Hydra, AIM, The Hand, and even more nefarious characters that we haven't seen yet. So that looks to be very cool, and he's trying to expose the Avengers for war crimes. So a lot of cool stuff going on. Of course we talked about Smallville season 11. Moji, what you got on the pull list? What kind of pulls are you getting? Get your pull!
Yes, I got my pull. Almost too many of them so far. I'm reading both Detective Comics and just regular Batman. Those have been really awesome. Those are the only comics, or some of the few comics out of the New 52 that they didn't just fully reset. You know, they still, I'm not going to go over it. You can go read the timeline online, but they still basically keep all the old Batman events like they happened, and so it's really not, you know, just a complete restart, but it is like a reintroduction of the characters, and you'd think that would be some of the hardest, because they don't get to start from scratch, but those might be my two favorites of them reading. They've been really good. Reading Action Comics, It's really good. It's, you know, the deal where with all of the new 52 where they've, you know, just recently figured out that there are superheroes around, and with Superman, you know, that's a really cool thing. Reading Wolverine and the X-Men, read the first few of those, it's different. It's, you know, it's got the kind of the built-in humor for it that, you know, Wolverine is now the headmaster at the old X-Men Academy, which he's renamed the Jean Grey School for Higher Learning. So, you know, there's lots of good just little jokes and stuff built in where there's a lot of little asshole kids that Wolverine's trying to teach to act like adults, which is weird. Just started reading Amazing Spider-Man. Read just one issue of it, and it was pretty cool so far. They've started like a new arc, and they're about to do tie-ins with it and Daredevil and Avenger, and apparently everything is going to tie in. So you apparently have to buy like 90 comics in the next 3 months if you want to know what all happens. But those are all cool stuff. And also, I'm reading Justice League, which is also cool. It's probably got the most action of any comic. It's not a terrible lot of story happens. They're actually like 5 issues in, and the events have spanned like an hour. But there's all sorts of great, like, you know, it's pretty much just the equivalent of a special effects laden Hollywood movie in a comic.
Yeah, I'm going to voice in a little bit on some comics. I don't get pulls. I don't read comics anymore because I can't afford to, because I do too many other geeky things that require a lot of money. But I don't know. I might get back into it because that 52 is really awesome. At least the one Detective Comics I read was really good. And I heard a lot of people like hate on the relaunching of the DC stuff, or I saw a few people trolling on it.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And I don't really get it because I think it looks like they've done a really awesome job. It's like, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, before we were on the air about how, I mean, come on, the guys, they've had the same continuity going for, you know, what, 60 years, you know. Let them freshen things up a little bit, you know. Like, for instance, Muji probably never would have started reading comic books because, I mean, it is daunting when you're like, oh, I went through it when I did read comic books, you know, really hardcore, which is like, you know, maybe 10, 11, 12 years ago, where it was like, I really want to start, you know, really consistently reading comic books, you know, where... Oh, let me start reading this. Oh, it's right in the middle of a story arc, or it's, you know, there's so much history there that you don't really know, and it's just, it can seem daunting. I think they've done a really good job. Well, it looks like, I like it a lot more than how they did with, like, the Ultimate Marvel Universe, where everybody was, like, basically brought back as, like, teenagers. I think it's cool that basically they're still giving them, it's like they're rebooting it, but it's not really, because it's like they're still, like, past there. Like, I read that first issue of, Detective Comics, and it was like, had the Joker in it, which is like, oh, of course, the first issue has the Joker in it. But it's cool because it's like, it kind of makes you think, oh, he's already been chasing the Joker for a few months, and now maybe he's catching him, but then it goes into like a fucking totally twisted thing there at the end that I thought was really cool and wasn't seeing coming. You know, I was almost criticizing it for a second there towards the end. I was like, oh, you know, man, they really could have done, oh, no, they could have done more or better, because this right here was badass, you know, and it really got me wanting to read more of it. And I read a little bit of that X-Men, that Wolverine X-Men, and it was really... It was the lighthearted, definitely lighthearted. Seemed pretty cool, pretty neat.
Yeah, and of course, fans, you want to go check out the archive of the Midnight Black Mass at blogtalkradio.com/PSP. Actually, I had a very exclusive interview a couple of weeks ago with Wolverine and the X-Men writer Jason Aaron, who took us very in-depth into the making of that comic and a great interview. And going to close it up here in just a few minutes, but one last topic of debate before we go off the air. This roundtable discussion has been quite enjoyable. We don't really talk a lot of Star Wars here on the show, but it's just kind of an understood thing if you're a nerd, and especially if you grew up in the 80s, then, by God, you love you some fucking Star Wars, and certainly the debate has raged since the prequels came out. Of, you know, the validity of the franchise, what sort of way did they have? Did George Lucas really rape your childhood? There's a documentary out there now called The People vs. George Lucas that's very informative. And, you know, old George, I got to say, man, you're really trying hard to defend your position. A news story has come out this week that Lucas is going on record as saying that Han Solo was never intended to shoot first, and that he did not shoot first. However, if you watch this documentary, The People vs. George Lucas, they clearly show footage of the original cut. Clearly, Han Solo shoots first. Very clearly. And then, of course, in the remastered version, like, Greedo shoots at him off the wall from 2 feet away to make it look like he shot first, and he couldn't hit him from 2 feet away, and Han Solo shot him. So, you know, what do you think of what are the thoughts of the round table about old Daddy George and his money?
You know, I guess this is just like, you know, he's just really trying to cover himself. And I don't hate how Lucas has done this, you know, all these years after the fact. You know, like I've heard him that he said that when he put out Star Wars originally that it was never intended to be the finished product. Like he kind of like, I guess, implying that he knew years down the line that there was these certain changes he wanted to make, which I just think is such bullshit. You know, it seems like in those prequels that it was really like, I didn't get the feel that this was a story that he had in mind all along. I really feel like it was something that he threw together, which is really crappy considering how many years were between, you know, episode 6 and episode 1, you know, that he could have put together something really good. It really gets the sense to me that it wasn't like that, that it was like maybe the last few years leading up to episode 1. It was like, oh, okay, well, here's our story. And when I watched all the movies in the theater, I liked them immediately. I was like, oh, badass, 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 because I was a kid, like we all were, that grew up loving Star Wars, had been taught for 10 years before the movie came out that they were going to make the prequels. You'd always wonder when they were going to do it. And, you know, there was always cool little things he would throw in there that was like a cool little payoff for you, like seeing Yoda fight with a lightsaber. But the more I've gone back and rewatched these movies, it's like when you get past the real, like, this, like, just like almost like a token gesture of like, oh, Yoda fighting with a lightsaber, a fight between Yoda and the Emperor, you know, oh, how cool. And it's like when you really get past all of that stuff, it's like there's just something to a whole lot of substance, you know, and it was also really hard to really get sympathy for some of the characters. Like, I hated Anakin Skywalker was just the worst. He was just, my God, he was the worst. And as far as, like, Lucas and, like, the Greedo shooting first, you know, it's like the evidence is there in the original copy, you know, obviously he didn't shoot first. And also it's like that it goes against his own canon that he created in that Jabba wanted Han Solo alive. You know, why would he be no, why would Boba Fett say he's no good to me dead? He's no good to me dead. Except for fucking Greedo. It's like Greedo obviously just was the worst fucking, you know, that guy was the worst, obviously. If he did shoot first, he's just the worst bounty hunter there ever was. I don't see how he even found Han Solo to begin with.
Yeah, I think a couple things. One, I think about it like two different ways. One way is just I choose to ignore most of these things. It's just like anything else. I mean, it truly is, you know, it's George Lucas's stuff. So if he wants to change things or do whatever he wants, then, you know, he can. But the problem is that George Lucas has just gotten fat. Like, fat in the way that, like, most people do. When he made the first Star Wars, he was, you know, just like all of, like, his peers at that time, just a maverick filmmaker. He was looking, you know, he rejected the Hollywood system. He felt like he'd been rejected by it. And he was out to prove them wrong. And that's why the original thing was so awesome. You know, he put everything into it. You can really see in movies most of the time when somebody, like, puts their heart and soul into making it. If he was making those movies just, you know, tell everybody, screw off, you know, I'm telling this is what I can do. And it was very obvious when he made the new movies. I didn't hate them, you know, but they were business. They were made just simply for the fact of making money, like, more than anything else. So when the first movie came out, if you're towards kids, you know, Happy Meals were coming out of McDonald's before the movie was even out. They were looking, you know, to make their money, like, as much as they could. And that's what those, you know, movies were more about. You know, I mean, he didn't even write all that stuff. A lot of the things he picked, like, you know, bits and pieces from books and different things like that that other people had written and just kind of pieced it all together. I mean, there's, you know, I just don't think that there's much heart in the newer movies. And then since then, and it's once again, I mean, like Lucasfilm, it's just a business. I think he looks back and, you know, says, oh, I can't have Han Solo trying to kill somebody because I'm still trying to sell kids cartoons. And, you know, they've got that new show coming out before long, the live action show that's coming on network. So they want little kids, and stuff to like it. And they want it, you know, in this new G-rated world that we live in, you know, they want it that, you know, we didn't live in the 70s, anything that could be possibly taken that way. You know, they have decided, you know, I have to change it. And it's just all about the money.
Fucking space pirate. He was a space pirate. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, he was scum. I mean, what? He was hanging out in Mos Eisley. That's where Obi-Wan said it. That's where the scum and villainy go. I mean, come on. That's, well, why would Han Solo be there if he wasn't scum? But And that's cool to hear that they're doing that TV show. I hadn't actually heard that, because that was what came out, I guess it was right after episode 3.
Oh, years ago.
It was years ago, right after episode 3, and, you know, it was supposedly supposed to be, like, the years between episode 3 and episode 4. Is that still the case on this show? Does anybody know if they said?
Yeah, that's
the case. Well, that's pretty cool. I'm for that. While I generally shit on a lot of the, you know, other stuff they've done other than the core three movies, which also I can make the point that I didn't say before, those original Clone Wars cartoons, we can all agree, were completely the shit.
Yeah, and honestly, like, the new Clone Wars cartoons, watch them, because they're good. They're way better than any of the prequels. Just, like, they're along the same lines of the original and similar creative teams, but just done with CGI animation as opposed to the more traditional animation, and it's awesome. It totally realizes the world of Star Wars in a way the prequels just didn't do.
Yeah, and, like, another thing I didn't understand was, like, I knew people that never watched those original Clone Wars cartoons, which was such a crime, I felt, because it just was, it really added a lot to those first three movies, or to episodes 1, 2, and 3. It really made 2 and 3 better, having it in between, and I don't understand how people that didn't watch those would understand certain things in episode 3. Like General Grievous, it's like, well, he pretty much just seems like he sucks. You know, I mean, like, how do you give a shit about him in episode 3? You know, about him, you know, he's like this big Jedi killer and stuff. One more thing before I pass it off, also, they talked about he was starting to entertain the idea of doing the next 3 episodes after 6.
He's not
going to 79.
He just produced this movie that's out right now. It's called Red Tails. Yeah, Red Tails, and he announced that was going to be the last live-action movie that he ever, like, produced, was a part of. Like, he'll write it. But, you know, he only directed a couple of the movies he's ever done, so, this was just as much him as the last Star Wars. You know, he produced it and everything like that.
But you said that's going to be the last live action movie.
Yeah.
Maybe they do those three episodes in, you know, like a CGI format, maybe.
There's also the fact that, you know, George Lucas is really old now, and Lucasfilm is, you know, going to keep going. So I would be willing to bet that there ends up being sequels eventually, because they're just going to want to make money, and Lucasfilm is going to make more money after he dies.
They're going to remake the original Star Wars. That will get remade here in about 10 years or so, I bet. The original Star Wars will get fucking remade with new actors and stuff.
And we'll all hate it, but we'll all go watch it.
Yeah, just like the 3D. I'm not excited at all. Like, I mean, I'm not generally not one to overly like 3D. I'm not as maybe as big of a hater on 3D as some of the people I know. Not that excited about Star Wars in 3D because it wasn't shot for 3D, you know. But I'll definitely go see them just because who could pass up fucking Star Wars in 3D? Not excited about Vader going, no, when he saves Luke either. Fuck that. I vowed never to watch it. I'm breaking my vow. That sucks.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably won't check The Phantom Menace in 3D. I like Clone Wars a lot better than it, so I'll probably check it and the third one in 3D. And then, you know, if they do the originals, why not? Just to go see Star Wars in the theater again. But I don't know. I'll be going into it with mixed emotions.
So you won't go and see the first Star Wars in 3D, but you're going to pay money for you and a date. Mind you, two movie tickets, to go and see Ghost Rider 2.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And because, A, it's a matinee, because you know I'm a cheap son of a bitch. And, two, you know, the first Ghost Rider movie fucking sucked out loud. I'm not going to make any excuses for it at all, but it's something, and it's certainly gotten much more favorable reviews than the first one. I think CGI has come a long way since the first one came out. So at the very minimum, I'm expecting $5 worth of special effects and Ghost Rider breathing some fire and some shitty Nick Cage one-liners. And to me, that's okay.
Yeah, I think that if this Ghost Rider is twice as good as the last Ghost Rider, I still wouldn't piss on it if it was on fire. That's it would still be awful.
Yeah, definitely. Even if it was maybe 3 times better, it would probably not be worth watching. And I don't know, I feel like Ghost Rider was never one of those comic characters I really gave a shit about. He's definitely a second-tier character would be probably really putting it nicely in Ghost Rider's case. I think Ghost Rider sucks in general. The movie, first movie was wretched.
Yeah, and the first movie, Nicolas Cage is the same dude in every movie now, so I'm glad if he would have played Superman, then that would have probably just made people kill themselves, like almost happened. But the first movie, though, it had Eva Mendez, one of the hottest chicks around, one of the worst actresses around. It had a bunch of other really good actors in it besides you know, that. And it was among the worst movies. I'm going to tell you something. I think it was probably the worst movie that I've ever seen in the theater. Ooh. I paid $1 to see it after it came to the cheap theater, and I really felt ripped off. And I've seen some really horrible things. I got tricked by Gustav and saw Primeval. I thought that was about a serial, which is a whole different stupid thing. That movie was previewed as Jack the Ripper, Ted Bundy, Gustav. It didn't show the fucking Amazon. But back on the track there, I enjoyed that movie with a fucking killer alligator better than I did Ghost Rider.
Well, plenty of Ghost Rider hate. I've never been a huge fan of the character. I've always thought that he never really got the right writer on as far as that could find his voice and make him memorable. I think Jason Aaron, actually, that was one of the first things that turned me on to his work was that he did a Ghost Rider miniseries called Heaven's on Fire, and it was like a six-parter, and it was the first Ghost Rider thing that I'd ever read that I actually enjoyed. So I was like, this guy's got to have some talent. So I read more of his stuff. Of course, eventually he came on the show. But, yeah, you know, that's certainly not an uncommon opinion in the comic book world, gentlemen. And I'm not claiming that it's going to be good, but, you know, I got low expectations, so hopefully I'll be pleasantly surprised. And one of the biggest problems in the first Ghost Rider, aside from the shitty acting and the somewhat bad story and the effects not being great, was the shitty villains. Like, the villains just totally fucking sucked in the first Ghost Rider. They were demons or whatever, but they were just like, you know, the emo goth kids is what they took the form of. And so, So who the hell is that going to fucking scare? You know, I've seen some of the heels in this new Ghost Rider, and they, you know, some pretty impressive, menacing specimens. So, you know, hopefully that'll have some sort of redemption, fans. But that's all we got for another edition of the Midnight Black Mass. We'd like to thank our special guest, Leslie Donaldson, for coming on the show. We'd like to thank our compound round table of geekery, Rufus Black of the Devil's Rejects and Muji of the Muji Movie Minute. And next week we will not be here. I know you're going to miss us. Your heart's going to hurt, but the Rev's going to be busy, tied up doing other things. We're taking a week off, but we'll be back the following Friday night. Want to stay tuned to our official Facebook page, facebook.com/midnightblackmass. Make sure you head over there and like it. Post a lot of interactive content through the week on there. A lot of YouTube videos of various films that we're going to be reviewing, a lot of previews. Do a lot of the songs and interviews, news bites. You know, you can get an inside scoop on what's going to be on the Midnight Black Mass by heading over to our official Facebook page. But that is all we've got for you tonight, fans. Thank you very much for joining us. Keep one foot in the gutter and one fist in the gold. I'm the Reverend. Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.